Good evening and welcome to Noir on the Radio. Hope you're having a nice Sunday evening. We got to spring the clocks forward this weekend, which means everything's going to be screwed up for the next couple of days. But it seems like a good enough time for a special edition of Noir on the Radio on a Sunday evening. And so what are we doing tonight? We're doing something totally new for this show. When Tony Knighton was on a couple months ago, we were just, you know, talking before the show went live and, you know, just about books and authors and things we liked. And we talked about Richard Stark and the impact his writing had on us. And, you know, we kind of talked about how it would be cool to have some other writers get together and talk about that some more. So tonight we have a panel of writers together, and we're going to talk about the author Richard Stark and his Parker novels and the influences that they've had on crime fiction as we know it today. And if you're familiar with Richard Stark, if you're not familiar, you've got some great reading to look forward to after tonight. But if you do know him and you know his work, then you probably know that Richard Stark was one of several pen names used by the best-selling novelist Donald Westlake. And, you know, Westlake was just amazing. He was a bestseller under his own name, and he was a bestseller under Stark. He was a screenplay writer. He was just everything. But we won't have time to go into to Westlake and all that tonight. The show's going to be all about Richard Stark. Because while Westlake was amazing, I think Stark is essential. Stark wrote 24 novels about his character, Parker. He wrote four others about a character that we may not talk so much about tonight. But we've got a lot to get into. And I've got the best panel ever to discuss this. So joining me on the panel are four of the most compelling voices in current noir fiction that are out there. And I'm going to quickly introduce each one. First up is S.A. Cosby. And Cosby has been published in numerous anthologies and magazines, including Thuglit, Yellow Mama, Fast Women and Neon Lights, Cheap Jack Pulp, and many more. His debut novel, My Darkest Prayer, is currently making the rounds with several interested publishers. Sean Cosby, thanks for being on the panel tonight.
Oh, well, thank you for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's great. Rob Pierce is with us as well. Rob wrote the novels Uncle Dust and With the Right Enemies, the novella Vernon the Heat, and the short story collection The Things I Love Will Kill Me Yet. He lives and will probably die in Oakland, California. Rob, welcome back.
Thanks, Greg. Good to be here.
Thank you. Also joining us is Tony Knighton. Tony's story collection Happy Hour and Other Philadelphia Cruelties was published in 2015 by Crime Wave Press. He also has published short fiction in Crime Factory, Static Movement Online, and Dark Reveries, and in anthologies from Cemetery Dance, Gray Matter Press, and Comet Press. Hey, Tony, welcome back to Noir on the Radio. Thanks for being on the panel tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great. And last but not least, we've got Eric Pruitt on the panel. Eric Pruitt is a screenwriter, author, and filmmaker living in Durham, North Carolina. His novels Dirt Bags and Hashtag are available now, and What We Reckon will be published by Paulus Books in October. He's currently working on a short Southern noir film titled Going Down Slow, starring Meredith South and Michael Howard. Eric, great to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
Man, thank you very much, Greg, for having me on.
It's great. Excuse me. So, guys, here's kind of where I want to start tonight, and it's with the character Parker. You know, Stark created something unique, I think, with this character. You know, Parker doesn't have a lot to say. You know, he keeps his mind focused on his work. He's a consummate professional whose profession happens to be theft, and I think most importantly for me, he's completely amoral, or at least he has a different code of ethics, you know, maybe than the rest of us. Westlake described Parker, the Parker series, as, quote, the consistent ruthlessness of an unapologetic bastard. And, you know, Tony, I want that's a good quote, and that's from the man himself. Tony, I want to start with you. I've read your stuff. You don't write about nice guys. So what is it about Parker and your characters, or any of these other ruthless, unapologetic bastards out there that we like so much?
I think when I started writing, I was drawn to writing about bad guys mainly because I didn't know enough about police work to write a procedural. And they've been done, and I'd have to do a lot of research. And I have a background in construction, and I've been a fireman in Philadelphia for over 30 years, so I've broken into lots of places. And I think that way. And I think writing from the point of view of the bad guy is just a lot more fun.
It's definitely, a fresh take on the crime genre to write about the criminal, himself. Sean Cosby, I know you write about some good people, but flawed people, but you also have some outlaws in your stuff as well. What's your take on this Parker character and, writing about the bad guy?
I think for me personally, Parker is he's a crime archetype. He's one of the pillars of crime fiction. You have the positive or good guy detective. You have obviously the villain or the crime, the mastermind, what have you. And then somewhere in the middle, you have what could be conceivably called the rogue. And Parker is on the dark end of the spectrum of the rogue. He's, to quote Raymond Chandler, he's a man who walks the dark streets. He's neither tarnished nor afraid. He may be a little bit tarnished, but he's definitely not afraid. And so he's basically, I think, the id for a lot of people who enjoy the work. He does and says things that sometimes we'd like to do. I mean, I don't know anybody who's ever worked for an employer or worked with a group of people who haven't wanted to kill one of them at one time or another. So I think Parker definitely illuminates that idea. And for me personally, he was a direct influence on a character that I write about in my short fiction, Skunk Mitchell. He's I wouldn't say he's a pastiche of Parker, but he's, if you did a family tree, he'd be the redneck cousin. And so he definitely influenced that idea. And for me personally, as a writer, when I write the skunk novels as opposed to like the more positive characters, like the character Nathan Waymaker in my book, Skunk is, again, my id. He's the darker side of my personality. Whereas some of my characters will, they'll give you a good old-fashioned ass open if necessary. Skunk will probably heat up a coat hanger and punch it in your eye. So he's the next level of rage and outrage sometimes, and he speaks for me as far as some of the things that I find unconscionable. And to get back to your question, I think Parker is that in a much better and a much more skillful alliteration of that idea.
He has maybe a little more discipline. I got to tell you, I love Skunk as a character, and I can't wait for everybody to really get to know this guy more in the future. But I love that description of Parker being the id of the reader, because I kind of do the same thing. I think of my character Selena as she's the kind of person, if some people, not everybody, but some people, if they just did what they wanted to do in the moment and didn't care about the consequences, that's kind of who she is. But she's, unlike Parker, she's more emotional, she's sloppier, she's less experienced, and I think she's willing to go places and do things that Parker wouldn't. But I could never have written that character had I not read Parker. So I love that description of the id of the reader. Rob Pierce, you write about some real ruthless bastards yourself. Was Parker an influence, and if so, how?
Well, yeah, definitely, because my first novel, Uncle Dust, is about a guy who's a working class criminal, which is really the way I look at Parker. He's a guy who's got a job. He may like the violence. He certainly doesn't mind it, but mainly he does whatever is necessary to get the job done, because because he likes what he likes, and some of that's money, and some of it might be violence. We don't really get to know specifics in the books of what Parker likes. Parker makes a lot of mistakes in the books, which is where a lot of the plots spring from. He's not, you know, like driven to suicidal mistakes like Dust is, but he's a huge influence on my work in that that just it's seeing a criminal without laying down the judgment. It's just telling the story. And when you talk about him being amoral, I was thinking he's just like – he's like the flip side of Sam Spade, who does a lot of things just to get things done. But deep down, he's going to do what he thinks is right, whereas Parker's going to do what he thinks will get the job done. And he doesn't delve into matters of right or wrong.
Yeah, I like that pointing out the mistakes that Parker makes, because – when you're reading these novels, you know, he's so confident and he's so driven and he's so strong-willed. You get the comfortable sense that he's in control. He knows what he's doing. Things are going to go well, but they never go well. And it's usually because in this group dynamic, because he's working with a crew, he misjudges somebody or he makes the wrong decision here, but things fall apart because of Parker somehow overlooking some, you know, some aspect of, or not being as concerned about something as he should. And I think that's, you know, to Westlake's, Stark's credit, his ability to portray that group dynamic and just the number of variables that can go wrong in these stories and, you know, how Parker reacts in these situations, because none of these are really about things going well. You know, these are all the stories about things falling apart. Eric, you know, what's your take on Parker, the character, and, you know, why do we like this guy?
Man, I like him. I like him mostly because, you know, the way I like to write is that I like to come from the point of view that there's nobody out there that really thinks they're the bad guy. You know what I mean? There's nobody that thinks that they're the villain. And here's Parker robbing people and killing people, and he always seems to have a reason for it. You know, I'm usually trying, when I'm reading, especially this darker noir hardboiled stuff, I'm trying to find the reason that somebody had, the morality that somebody has behind their reason, but behind their actions. And I can line up pretty well with Parker because, in my opinion, you know, banks are there to be robbed. You know, like rich people out there, they should be robbed. So for some of them, that's their only fucking job in life, is to be fleeced by people that are smarter than them. And that's what, like, it, by extension, Parker gets to do that for me, like 25 times. As far as a character goes, it's being written. A lot of times I find every other character in the book infinitely more interesting than Parker, because Parker, you know, doesn't make mistakes. He's a man of few words. He's like a machine. You get down to, like, you know, he's got like his routines and sex and all, everything, but like everybody else is allowed to be an asshole. And that's kind of, I love reading to other people and the big, you know, I'm on the edge of my seat wondering, oh, is this asshole going to live through this book or not? You know, because we all know Parker's going to make it. There's 25 books.
This is too much fun. I love that. I think you know, when I look at my own work, when I wrote a book called Road Carnage, and I'd just gone back and reread, you know, the first 7 or 8 Parker novels just prior to writing that book. And I think the thing that bled over in Road Carnage from the Parker stuff is how everyone and everything kind of bends to Parker's will, you know, not for their betterment. He exerts his will on everyone around him, and, you know, ultimately things kind of work out. And, you know, I think I see some of that coming through in Road Carnage, where Selena plowed into and through, you know, pretty much every hurdle that came her way, no matter who got hurt in the process, you know, even herself. You know, got any other thoughts on Parker as a character, though, before we move on?
Yeah.
I do have a thought. One of my favorite scenes in any of the books came in, I think it was The Outfit, when early on Parker's writing the letters to the other mechanics that he knows, the other people in the business, because he's having trouble with the mob, and he's just writing these letters in the hopes that if they had a score in mind that would hurt the mob, that he wishes they would go ahead and do it. And, you know, he writes a sentence that they think they have a grievance with me, and he misspells grievance. And he writes the letter, and he looks at it, and he knows something's wrong. And he's in an apartment in the middle of the night all by himself. And he picks up the phone, and he calls the operator and asks her how to spell grievance. And she doesn't know, but she asks somebody. And that scene says so much about that character. Parker prevails most of the time because he's the smartest guy in the room, but he doesn't know everything. He doesn't know everything, but he's concerned about being right. He's concerned about knowing the right thing to do. And it was a goofy little scene. I thought it said a lot. And that's my two cents.
I agree. That's a very telling scene.
That's great.
I remember that, and I'm glad you brought that up. Somebody else had a thought.
I was just going to interject that, as Eric said, Parker is this machine. I find that interesting because, A, I'm sort of a nerd. So I love the essential groundwork for the capers, and I love to see how it's going to go awry or how it's going to go screw. It's this, you know, the capers are these Rube Goldberg creations in a literary sense, and I'm just wondering whether Mousetrap isn't going to close correctly or properly. And I admire Westlake by painting Parker as a character into these situations and then allowing his strongest characteristics to help him prevail. That's a sign of a really good writer, that you don't use, a Deus Ex Machina trope to try to get your character out of a situation. You create a character, you give him what you hope are good qualities, positive, strong qualities, and then you use those qualities to help him escape whatever conflict there is. And there are a few characters who do that quite as explicitly and quite as expertly as Parker. So that was just my two cents on it.
No, man, that's a good point. And, you know, some of my favorite of the Parker novels, and we'll talk about structure here in a bit too, is when they're planning the heist, they're setting things up, and always in the Parker novels, you'll have three parts of the four-part book from, you know, Parker's perspective, and there'll be one part that's from someone else or, you know, a collection of other people's perspectives, and sometimes it's not until you get into that section of the book that you find out how things are going to go bad. And it's sometimes it's one of the members of the team is going to pull a double cross, or, you know, there's a cop out there watching things. And sometimes it's something completely unexpected, like a salesman who can't sleep at night, and he looks out the hotel window and he sees this power company van and these guys, you know, kind of tooling around. You never know where things are going to go wrong sometimes until you get to that part of the book. So one of the things, you know, that strikes me, Stark is not the only guy to do this kind of thing. Jim Thompson, I mean, there were a lot of people who wrote about bad guys as the protagonist. And, you know, I think Parker's a little different. You can kind of like the guy a little bit. But you know, there's always this propensity for people to become victims just because they wander into Parker's path, innocent people. And just when you start to like the guy, Stark has this way of reminding you there's nothing endearing about this character whatsoever. And there's tons of examples of what I think of as collateral damage. There's the asthmatic lady and the hunter, the kid who winds up being buried in the hole he dug in Joe Shear's basement, in the jugger, lots of others. And it's not that, that Parker wants to hurt those people. He's just kind of a dangerous guy. And the one example that,
that kid in the jugger was not innocent.
Well, that's a good point. he was trying to do the same type of thing Parker was, I believe, in that book.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think the one that hit me the hardest was it was in the rare coin score, where at the end of the whole thing, Parker and Claire, and you know Claire is someone that's close to him in like 16 of the 24 books, and you know she feels guilty for what went down. Her friend Billy Lebatard was killed in this heist, and she felt like it's her fault. And you know Parker says, "Do you want to go turn yourself in?" And she, you know, she shakes her head. She says, "No, I don't want to go to jail." And you know, Stark writes that Parker was relieved, but he didn't show it because if she had said yes, he would have had to kill her, and that would have bothered him, but it would have been necessary. So that's you know just how dangerous this guy is. You know that somebody who's close to him, his girlfriend Claire, she could have been put on ice pretty quick in that book. So I want to get reactions, you know, on the concept of collateral damage and that impact. And I'll start with Eric. You know, they're sheep and they're wolves, right? What are your thoughts on these innocent victims in these stories?
Man, okay, first off, I know that it's necessary because, we're, you know, you can't really have an anti-hero unless the anti-hero is doing, you know, really crappy things. You know, I saw it with Tony Soprano. And by the way, Jim Thompson is my... This is my favorite. If I had a spirit animal slash drinking buddy, it'd be Jim Thompson. But, you know, it took me a little while to come to Jesus, especially with the asthmatic woman from The Hunter, because that's the one that kept bugging me. I kept thinking that there's just no reason, really, that you can randomly kill this woman. Like, this guy, you know, he walks in, and for those of you that haven't read The Hunter, he's staking out somebody else. He goes across the street to this laundromat, or is it a – wasn't it a laundromat, or was it a – yeah. Basically, his business, he goes in there and a woman owns it, a beauty salon or something. This woman owns it. He knocks on the door. She lets him in. He punches her across the face, knocks her out, checks out her legs, and is like, yeah, maybe later. And, like, as she's unconscious, she can't get her inhaler, and she dies. And then he's just like, oh, well, and then rolls through the rest of the movie. It just kept, I mean, through the rest of the show. It kept bugging me. I mean, excuse me, but it kept bugging me because, I kept thinking, like, something's got to come out of this. Like, I don't know. Like, her kid's going to grow up, and in book number 24, he's got, you know, Parker's going to answer for it. Or the cops are going to get him for nailing that woman. And, I mean, I'll raise my glass to Stark Westlake for you know, pointing out how random everything is. You know, that's great. But I think what it really ends up doing is raising the stakes. Because, like I said, I find all the other characters interesting. When you're looking at the real estate agent in Flashfire, you kind of start to like her. You see her reasoning, but at the same time, there's no stakes there if you're not thinking that at any minute Parker could say, you know what, hey, I got to off this lady, and he'll do it. And then one other quick aside on that is I've often wondered just, you know, as being a writer myself and having, you know, taken on this business, you know, Westlake always said he never expected anything to go past The Hunter. He was like, this is a one-off book, and at the end, he was going to go to jail. Parker was going to go to jail, and that was going to be it. But then somebody came out and said, hey, well, can you write three of these? It makes me wonder if, because there weren't as many collateral damages after The Hunter. I kept looking for them. And it makes me wonder, is that just something that, like, since it was the first book, he was throwing in there so we wouldn't feel bad when the guy got arrested at the end, or, you know, if he would have known there was going to be 23 books after it, would he have kept doing it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good thought. He did become a little bit different of a character. Go ahead, Tony.
I agree with you on just about everything on that, but I have to take exception to the point that he didn't care, because he did care. It was unprofessional. He should have known better. He knew he was smarter than that, and it could only make trouble for him. So he wasn't upset that the lady had died because he was a nice guy. It was out of self-interest, but he cared deeply. He felt it was sloppy. and was afraid that it might come back on him. So it's not that he was, I don't know. Now I'm rethinking what I'm saying, but he did care about it. It wasn't like, oh, fuck it. Mainly, he did care, but his care was out of self-interest. So
he didn't care in a way that would make anybody sympathize with him.
Yeah. Well, right.
I mean, the collateral damage thing for me, is actually, like, to Eric's point, it makes the books interesting because, you know, there's a randomness to life in general, and there's definitely a randomness to Parker. And I never read those books thinking that Parker is a sociopath, that he enjoys the violence. Even in the politically incorrect now, but even in some of the books where he's, you know, a little handsy with some of the women, it's never out of a visceral or atavastic enjoyment of the action of violence against women or men. It is the machine-like idea that I have to do this to complete my task, you know. And so when there's collateral damage, whether it's in, you know, the man with the getaway face or the score or the outfit, like there's a scene in the outfit where he goes to get a car from a guy who, sells hot cars or cars with fake VIN numbers and what have you. And there's a woman there, the guy's wife, and she's hitting on him and so on and so forth. And then when the guy comes back from wherever he went, she hollers rape. And he slaps her around a little bit and slaps the guy around and, you know, basically get your woman in control. But it's never, the feral enjoyment of beating somebody. It's just, you know, just give me the damn car. I don't have time for this. And you get that a lot with Parker, even when there is collateral damage. It's never something that he even enjoys in the slightest, you know. And just to make one more point real quick, like in the movie Heat, which I think was directly inspired by some of Westlake's writing, there's a character who is basically a serial killer. And he, you know, causes the downfall of Neil McCauley and the rest of the crew. That character is so far removed from Parker, and it was really cool seeing it on screen where you have the Neil McCauley character who could be called Parker, and I think he's Parker and everything but name, and you have this other character, Mangold, who's like I said, basically a sociopath, and it's good to see that dividing line between the professional who will hurt people if necessary and then the sociopath who, for lack of a better phrasing, gets off on it. So
I think that's a good distinction. You know, it's kind of a means to an end, but with unintended consequences sometimes and complicating matters. But it's not like a conscious, you know, conscience. He doesn't feel guilt or remorse. It's, maybe a little regret from a professional perspective. Rob, your thoughts on collateral damage?
Well, you've read With the Right Enemies. I don't know. There's intentional, straightforward, going for it damage, and there's loads of collateral damage in there. And you know, I can't speak for Stark, but when I was doing it, I was just going for a realistic portrait of what a criminal would do. And if you're trying to get information from somebody, you take it to whatever point you think you need to get that information. If they could cause you to go away for a while, well, who the fuck wants to go away for a while? So, you know, again, it's just a totally understandable aspect of Parker's personality. And like a lot of Parker's personality, it's not a likable aspect, but you get it. The guy's doing his job and he's good at his job. And the only way to stay good at his job is to stay on the street, and he can't let anything take him off the street. So, there is a thing where people who aren't necessarily involved with the crime itself are close enough to the action that they can get hurt. It happens in real life. It definitely happens in Parker novels.
Man, I tell you, if that asthmatic lady in The Hunter bothers you, heaven help you when you read with the right enemies. Rob is the expert on collateral damage, and I won't say more than that. Tony, what are the thoughts on collateral damage?
Yeah, I've been since you brought this up, I've been trying to think of characters that were basically innocent that ended up getting having a bad time in the Parker novels. And the closest I can come to is the mourner when some people have abducted Handy McKay, and Parker's sort of he's racing against the clock to try to figure out where he is. And I think Handy was sweet-talking a woman who was a housekeeper in the place they were going to rob. And unless I'm forgetting, Parker tortures her until she gives up what she knows. And I don't think she was complicit in any sort of crime, although I might be wrong. But I think most of the people that don't fare well in the Parker novels are complicit somehow. They're in the life somewhere. So, you know, this is always a possibility, as Rob was saying.
Yeah, it's like it doesn't happen in every book, certainly, but I think, you know, every two or three there will be, you know, some unintended consequence where somebody gets hurt, and you really get a sense for the just what a jerk, you know, Parker can be, and how driven he is and uncaring. And that, you know, I think I think this might have been in one of the books or in one of the interviews. I know I use it in one of my books too, that he's compared to a shark. You know, he's somebody who's just out there doing his own thing, but if you're swimming along with him, you just might get hurt. Any other thoughts, guys, before we move on to Richard Stark and his writing style? Okay. I think we're good. Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
I was just going to say, I think also this may bleed into the writing style aspect, but I think also for a storytelling motif, collateral damage, it's sometimes necessary to move the story along. It's sometimes necessary to not just exemplify or show the character's characteristics, but also to keep the action going. I wrote a story that got published in Yellow Mama. It's a skunk standalone story, and it's a very lowbrow redneck heist where they are they're robbing a truckload of copper tubing and pipes, and one of the characters is the truck driver's in on it, and in the course of the crime, he's like, oh, you got to punch me in the face to make it look real. And so one of the guys that Skunk is working with punches him in the face and accidentally hits him in the throat and crushes his larynx, and he dies. And there's a guy that was riding along with him who I never explicitly say it, but in my mind when I was writing it, was the dude's dad. And, you know, he's all freaking out because the guy's dead, and Skunk kills him. He shoots him. And it's a necessary part of the story as far as thematically and for plot continuity, but also shows, you know, Skunk's characteristic. And I said again, he's a character very influenced by Parker. You know, he doesn't want to go to jail. He doesn't want to see the inside of a jail cell. And so, you know, old man got to go. And I think that's, also, and it's very important to the flow of the story. That's all I wanted to say about that.
Yeah. And I think it's definitely a technique used in fiction to kind of shape, you know, a character to show who they're becoming. And I think of one of the best examples, if you watch the show Breaking Bad, there's this scene where the character Mike Ehrmantraut, he's talking to Walter White, and he says, you know, there are two kinds of heists in this world. There are ones that are successful, and then there's the ones where you leave witnesses. And I think that was, you know, a little more on the nose than the kinds of things that that Westlake portrays in his books. It's almost like in a Westlake novel, you get that impact that, you know, this is who this character is because this thing happened. But it's almost like, I don't know, it's almost like it's just just something that happened without necessarily any meaning. He doesn't focus on that in quite the ways that a lot of us might in our fiction to show how horrible a character is becoming. Another topic I want to hear from the panel on is, you know, kind of Stark's approach to writing, and there's a handful of things that stand out to me. But first, he uses, you know, such lean, sparse, you know, prose, and I've been reading Westlake's The Axe over the last few days, and it's almost like he's a totally different writer in that book. It's deep POV. It's a lot of description. There's a lot of interior monologue, and there's none of that in the Parker novels. Not a lot of description. Few adjectives, fewer adverbs. You know, sometimes he uses this mechanical like description. Like he once said, Claire's voice was rusty. And then in the next chapter, he says another guy's voice sounded oily. And, you know, I want to bring Rob up on this first, you know, because Rob, you're not only an author, but you're also an editor. And I'm curious what you think about, you know, Stark's writing style. Would you cut lines from a Parker novel?
God, I don't know what I'd cut. You know, when we were talking hypothetically when I was on your show before, I said there's some stuff in Blood Meridian I'd cut, but McCarthy gets wordy. You know, I love the guy, but yeah, you know, what did he say? An extra he said somewhere that wasn't necessary. I don't know what you'd cut from a Parker novel. There may be a little somewhere where he ventured more into Westlake territory, but and got a little descriptive. But God, it was probably only a little. It probably was just fine staying on the page.
Tony, you write some lean stuff yourself. What do you think of Stark's style, and why does it work for this kind of fiction?
I'm sorry, were you talking to him? Who was that question for?
Hey, that was for Tony, but anybody can chime in.
Okay, well, Tony. I'll go. I heard the. I'm sure we've all listened to the interview with Mr. Westlake when he was talking about. He's talking about Richard Stark and. He, you know, the last name Stark, it's just, you know, cold, spare. Somebody else made an observation that the difference between the two styles, he gave a sentence from a John Dortmunder book, and the sentence goes on for five or six lines, and the same kind of idea in a Richard Stark novel was, the sentence was, Parker looked at the money. It wasn't enough. it just gets right to the point. And that's like the character. The character gets right to the point. He doesn't mince words. He doesn't use a lot of extra words. And I think that was one of the reasons I was drawn to the books in the first place. I enjoy that kind of prose.
There's definitely an efficiency to everything Parker does, and the writing style I think matches that that character. You know, I talked to Daniel Vlacity. It's been a few weeks ago with his new book, A New and Different Kind of Pain, and we talked about his writing style for that one, and then the previous book that he wrote, and the name of that one escapes me, but that one was written about an amphetamine addicted bike messenger, and the sentences were short, choppy, move fast, little clips of thoughts from this guy, and he said he wrote it that way because he wanted it to match that, you know, that character and the chemistry in his body and what was driving him. And I think that you see kind of the same thing here with Parker and Stark as a writer. The writing style is much like the man he's writing about. Sean, your thoughts on Stark's writing approach?
Well, I'll tell you, it's funny. I'm going through a process right now with some folks who are, I don't want to say the name of the agency because nothing's written in stone yet, but there's an agency that's looking at my my crime novel, and we're going through a little tête-à-tête because in this book, the character, the main character, is a very verbose. He can be very humorous, even though he's a very tough guy. And so I used a lot of verbosity, a lot of similes, a lot of metaphors to kind of exemplify that characteristic of him. It's almost a psychological defense mechanism for him, his humor, his jargon, so to speak. And so we're coming to a meeting of the minds with my book where they understand that that's an integral part of his character. Not comparing myself to Richard Stark at all, not even the same ballpark. I'm not even the same town. But the idea that Stark, when he writes, you know, I'm a big fan of the John Dornbarner series. I love those books. They're just as good as Parker books to me in a different way. But with Parker, every line in a Parker book is just, it's boss, it's lean, mean, it's stripped down. It's like it's like a Monte Carlo that's been stripped down to the factory paint, but can get up and go 150 miles in 6 miles per hour in 6 seconds. I mean, it's tense and terse, and you want it to be that way because you want that, you expect that from a Parker novel. You expect that type of staccato delivery of Parker's thoughts and actions. And it's a masterclass in sparse, but writing that's sparse, but that conveys an idea quickly and efficiently. But at some points, you know, Parker is never one for like self-reflection, but other characters, as Eric has pointed out so adroitly, other characters in the book, you can see glimpses of Westlake through, and for instance, in The Hunter, in Mal Reese's section where he's basically giving himself a monologue about why he shouldn't feel bad about what he did to Parker. It's a lot of language in there, a lot of long sentences where Mal is pumping himself up. And so you get this idea that, oh, these are two distinct characters without having to be told that. It's a masterful trick that very good writers can do. And so the prose matches the character very, very completely.
Well said, well said. You know, I think two of those chapters, like in the handle maybe, or maybe the score, where you'll have a chapter from another character's perspective, Alan Grofeld, and it's the same kind of thing. You know, the writing style adapts to the character, and it's totally different because, you know, Alan Grofeld it runs a theater, and he's a stage actor, and, you know, everything to him is all, you know, purple prose and flowery and overdone with flourish. And his style changes even in a Parker novel when he's writing from Grofeld's perspective. Eric, your thoughts on this lean Stark style?
Oh, I love that. I admire anybody, because anybody that can say things in very few words, because anybody that's talked to me knows that that's not a skill I have. I tend to talk for a long time, and not all the time do my sentences tend to go anywhere, which is my argument about the, you know, earlier talking about the meth guy, you know, saying that the sentences should be short and to the point. Anybody that's ever had an argument with somebody on meth knows that those sentences go all over the place, and they don't always end. So, but I know, like, you know, in my first novel, Dirtbags, I studied that old style. You know, Jim Thompson was real good at it. And I think, you know, the biggest progenitor to Richard Stark would be Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest. You know, every time I read Red Harvest, I just get blown away. I'm like, that man did more with a three-word sentence than I've probably done in one of my squirrely old paragraphs. But so I really worked in Dirtbags to try to boil my stuff down to that kind of level until, you know, and hashtag I let it breathe out a little bit. And the next book I have coming out in October, man, I'm just all over the place. This is my third book. I need to get away with some stuff. But the fact that Richard Stark was able to pull that off for 24 novels over, you know, a half century or however long, to keep it that short and economical is amazing.
Good stuff. Guys, any other thoughts on Stark's lean prose before we move on?
Just that a lot of writers that started in the 50s, they were trying to do that, and not all were successful as Stark or Jim Thompson. Jim Thompson and Richard Stark are right up there on the Mount Rushmore of that lean, mean style. I mean, I love Mickey Spillane. I love the Mike Hammer series, but it's not – I love it as almost a guilty pleasure because it's not great writing. It's not the worst writing in the world. Obviously, you know, a lot of people enjoy it, but it's almost a pastiche where Dashiell Hammett, Jim Thompson, and Richard Stark, their leanness, like I said, those short staccato sentences are saying so much. There's so much in between the sentences that's being said in like a 5 or 6, 7 word sentence that it really sticks with you. And, you know, it's often imitated, but very rarely duplicated.
Yeah, those guys were ones who did it well. And, you know, I don't know. I think, you know, Hemingway had a big impact, you know, back then on that type of writing style. I don't know to what extent, you know, he was an impact on people like Stark or Thompson. But you're right. A lot of people tried it. Few did it well. In Stark's hands, it's a masterpiece.
Well, Westlake tried damn near every style. You know, just under different names. He wrote romance novels, for Christ's sake. He was making a buck.
True.
He was definitely one of those old pulp guys that threw a little bit of everything out there. I want to talk about opening lines too, because I think nobody could open a novel like Stark. And I kind of think of his first lines as being something like, you know, the opening scenes in a James Bond movie. They all start with the character, you know, in the middle of doing something interesting. And even, you know, today when I sit down to write fiction, I mentally, you know, quote to myself that opening line to Stark's novel Firebreak. And that's because I think it's the perfect opening sentence. Yeah, you know, it goes like this. When the phone rang, Parker was in the garage killing a man. Yeah, how do you not?
You know, as you do,
by a line like that.
As you want.
Right.
So, you know, I want to put that sticker on my laptop that says that, or a poster over my desk. But I've got it in my mind, and I'll never forget it. But let's start with Sean. You know, starting strong from the first line. What do you think of his technique, and how do you relate to it as a writer? And not just how he opens a novel, but, you know, sometimes the chapters he opens that way.
I love the sharp, almost shocking opening line. I emulate it a lot in my writing, almost too much, I think, to a certain extent. But Stark did it so effectively because it does so much in one sentence. It grabs you. You know, I remember the first Richard Stark novel I read was Firebreak, and I was like about I'm dating myself now. I was in like 8th or 9th grade, and I was in our local library, and it was the large print edition that they were selling for like 50 cents because nobody wanted it, and I read it and I opened it. I was on a school bus, and by the time I got home to my house, I'd almost read half the book. We had a long ride, but I was reading fast. I couldn't put it down because that opening line grabbed me by the shirt and said, come on, we're going. And I just had to see where it went. And, you know, he was a master at doing it. And it's like everything that Stark did, it's a lot harder than it looks, you know, and you've got to come up.
Oh, it is.
When you do that or when you try that style, it can't be for shits and giggles. You can't do it just to be doing it. You do have to kind of follow it up with another supporting sentence or supporting paragraph that kind of props it up. If you try to use that style on a faulty foundation, your book's already falling apart or your story's already falling apart. It's already gone. And so I've tried to adapt that type of style into my own writing, and you know, and it's more difficult than you think. I mean, I think I did pretty good in the, like I said, the book that I'm working on and some of the short stories. But it, like I said, it's much more difficult than it looks. And you know, Stark was good at it. Was great at it, I should say. Thompson was good, of course. You know, and I thought for all the I guess I don't want to say complaints, but for all the notoriety that Chandler gets, Raymond Chandler gets for his incredibly florid prose, he did that in a lot of novels. Just open the book with this startling sentence, they're like, "Oh crap, what's going on here?" And so it definitely was an influence on my crime fiction, especially.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. It's not just about the opening sentence. It's about backing it up and carrying that forward in the book. And I like that, you know, in a lot of his books, the chapters all start in the middle of something happening. You know, somebody's fallen to the ground because, you know, Parker punched him when they opened the door. Rob, what do you think about these opening sentences of Richard Stark?
Well, I'm not exactly in the minority here. I love them. I think it works great because, yeah, when you do something in your life, you're never at the beginning. You may be at the beginning of a certain step, but there's all this shit that went on before it. So you've got all this context, and there's not time to give all the context, and no one wants to read all the fucking context anyway. You can get to that later. First of all, let's get the action going and get the reader into it. You know, I mean, there are definitely writers who've succeeded without that head rush of an opening. And even in crime fiction, Chester Himes, for example, would often start out more florid, but you know, when he got to his action scenes, those things went. And that's sort of the pace of Parker books, pretty not throughout, because he does have that other section in all the books, but for the most part in the Parker sections, it's all fast paced. And yeah, I want to agree with that point about the other stuff having to be there, because just because, you know, you want to write all these short little sentences to make your pace work, well, okay, that's fine, but you can't leave anything out. Just because you're not using very many words doesn't mean you get to leave out details. You get to emphasize the important ones and get on with it. But you leave out a goddamn bit of context, and you've got a lost reader because you're going so damn fast because you're so impressed with what you're doing, which I do in rough drafts all the fucking time.
Good point.
Not after that.
Tony Knighton, you know, you and I'm thinking of, you know, Happy Hour and the other Philadelphia cruelties, the book. Your stories hook readers from the first line, because when I read that, you know, I'd read a story, I'm like, man, that was fantastic. And then I'm just going to take a peek at what this next one is. And then the next thing I know, I'm taking a peek at what the next one is, and then the next one, and then the next one. You know, how does this work for a writer? And you know, what do you think of Stark's style of starting these stories?
The opening lines? I'm a member of the choir here, too. I love them, and I remember that admonishment from grammar school teachers, the opening line, how important that is. And you have to get your reader's attention. And they're all similar. They all start with the word when, and my favorite also is in Firebreak. You know, I've quoted that opening line to a lot of people and a lot of fans. And Westlake was a professional, and he knew what he was doing, and he was selling books in the '60s. He was trying to write books that were being sold in drugstores. And, you know, the cover was important, and the first line was important. That first paragraph was very important. And the guy knew what he was doing.
Oh, man, yeah, that's just a beautiful, image of, you know, standing in the drugstore and you're looking at the rack and then you see the cover and then you turn it and you read the first sentence, and he was competing on those racks. Eric, your thoughts on this?
Man, I think you provided a printout with every first line that there is. I think that would be great if you threw that on the Facebook page or whatever, so everybody could check it out. That is impressive. I'm going to not be a wet blanket here, but I'm going to go ahead and give the prize to that to Donald Ray Pollock. Still to this day, just took the prize for best first lines in my book. His short story, Hare's Fate, starts out with, "When people in town said inbred, what they really meant was lonely." I mean, that had me. My other favorite. We're allowed to cuss on this, right? Right?
God, I hope so.
We are. We are not FCC regulated, okay. So let it fly.
Okay, excellent. My number one favorite first line of all time is from Donald Ray Pollock's Dynamite Hole, where it says, "I was coming down off the Mitchell Flats with three arrowheads in my pocket and a dead copperhead hung around my neck like an old woman's scarf when I caught a boy named Truman Mackey fucking his own little sister in the dynamite hole." Like, I don't even know what the rest of that story is about. I just remember nothing follows that first sentence. So, I've always had I've always loved first lines in fiction, and yes, Richard Stark is definitely in that tradition, but everybody's a long way behind Donald Ray Pollock.
Well, I'll throw the first lines for the Stark novels up on there, and if you want to put the Pollock on there, you're welcome to do so.
I want Eric to put his picture
maybe
up
we can
with
do a
Sid
poll.
Haig.
That we need that one up there as well. So a couple more to go, guys. I kind of divide the Parker novels up into three separate eras. I think of the first date, you know, the Hunter through the Handle as being one group, and they're just kind of the hard-edged Parker novels in my mind. And then the next date, the Rare Coin Score through Butcher's Moon, you know, I think of those as you know, kind of the Claire novels. That was kind of a difference in those that weren't in the first date. And then there's that, you know, that gap of 23 years where there were no Richard Stark novels written from 1974 to 97. And it was a time when Westlake said he just, you know, no longer heard Stark's voice. The Parker character was dead. And, you know, I kind of get it because these novels are very much formulaic. You know, they start kind of the same way. They're broken up into the four sections, you know, the three from Parker's point of view, one from the antagonist. And there's only a handful of general plot types. So there's, you know, there's only so much you can do with him as a writer. And I read that Westlake said it wasn't until he was asked to write the screenplay for The Grifters that he tried to hear Parker's voice again, because the producer specifically said he wanted Stark to write the script, not Westlake. And he couldn't make it work. You know, he consciously tried, and he wound up, you know, telling the producer that Stark wasn't in the Screenwriters Union, so Westlake had to write it.
he did okay.
He did okay. It was a good movie, based on a good book. But he brought Stark and Parker back in 97, and he penned eight more Parker novels. And this was, I was kind of like Sean, this was the time when, you know, all of the Stark novels were out of print. You heard about them, you could never find them. And to me, this last era was filled with masterpieces, and it's my favorite group of the books, but that is probably because that was my first introduction to Parker. Was in that era, and I read those first. But Eric, I saw a picture of you today on Facebook, and you were laid back on a pile of Parker novels.
Oh yeah.
What I'm curious as to what era you would rate the highest and why.
Okay, I love that you gave us your eras ahead of time, because I kept I kept this in my head the whole time that I was looking, that I was catching up. I do love that first era. To me, you know, I love the first, like, four Ian Fleming James Bond books. And this, you know, after a while, they just kind of start to peter out. The Ian Fleming James Bonds, they just kind of peter out. They've got a formula. The veil is lifted. I'm not interested in continuing reading. And so that kind of sparked that out. Hey, this is an American. I can get behind it. This is great. I think that early era is like a Ian Fleming kind of crossed with Dashiell Hammett, that Red Harvest, you know, a little Jim Thompson in there. I thought that was great, meaning that your first eight books. I am not familiar with the score books, the first four books of the second era. I didn't read them. But the second four books of your second era, Deadly Edge, Slay Ground, Plunder Squad, Butcher's Moon, like Deadly Edge and the Slay Ground are my favorites. Like that, that's where, you know, I'm probably never going to, this is probably, this panel right here is probably the closest I'm going to be to being organized with a crew of heavy hitters, you know, to go out and slay some stuff. So it's always like the common man thing that gets me. And like Deadly Edge, the hippies and Slay Ground, the, you know, the town folk coming to get him. That to me was perfect. That those were great. You see it again in Ask the Parrot at the very end, but I'm going to slam that here in just a minute. That third, that last era, the fourth era when he's come back, like I really liked like Flashback and Backlash and Flashfire are my two favorite from that era, and I really, really like that. I thought that his way of reinventing an old character that's been reinvented through the times. Just keep in mind, like the whole Slay Ground thing and the Deadly Edge, that's hippies. And before that, you had like your enemy could have been like Don Draper. They were all faceless guys in suits. And then here we're coming back into a more modern era with cell phones, and it's great. I'm going to break with you on where you said that the fourth era's got eight books. I think it's got five and three. That Nobody Runs Forever, Ask the Parrot, and Dirty Money. In my opinion, those three books were not anywhere near the same. It was almost like Justified's last two seasons, you know, when they tried to go without Elmore Leonard, or even Game of Thrones trying to run without, you know, there's something missing there. And I didn't like it. The plot was too bumbling. There were so many times that the Parker from the earlier books would have walked away, and he just didn't. They kept adding more things into it, and I will almost accuse it of ghostwriting. I almost will. I don't want to get controversial here, but I'm almost like, do that one, Dan. That one, Dan.
Yeah, no, I'm going to be the least critical of all because I'm such a fan. But I see your point. You know, there was, when those last three books came out, there were, you know, there was this sense of the end is coming, right? And I think you're on the mark for sure. Tony, what's your favorite era of the Parker novels and why?
I don't know that I have a favorite. I like the eras that as you've described them all for different reasons. I like the very early stuff because there's a seaminess to the world that he creates in those books that he sort of loses after probably The Handle. And maybe it's because he meets Claire, but the world is a seedy place in those early books. And there's something really neat about that. I mean, even his narrative sort of changes. He robs a bar by himself that's an outfit bar, and there's a poster of a piano player outside the bar who's playing there, and he says, you know, in the narration, he says the poster was 20 years old. It was of a faggot playing a piano. And, you know, it's one thing to have that in dialogue, but to have that in your narrative, it just makes things creepy. And the books were kind of delicious because of that. As a sidebar, I think The Hunter stands all by itself because as Eric pointed out, this was going to be a one-off. And that book is really different from the rest of the series. Parker does a lot of things that he never does again. It just has a different feel. I agree with Eric that The Deadly Edge and Slayground are really fine. Along with those two, my particular favorites are The Sour Lemon Score and Plunder Squad. And I like The Last State. I do like them. Typically, when I'm trying to get a new convert, someone who's never read a Parker book, I tell them to start with Comeback, because you'll get a good sense from that book out of like what the whole series is like. And in the 90s, Mr. Westlake was a master. I mean, it's not that he wasn't, not that his talents weren't formidable when he was as a young man, but he was a master at that point. He knew exactly what he was doing and why he was doing it, and I think that book's a great introduction. I agree that the very last three do have a different flavor, but I like them anyway, and I really like Ask the Parrot because, as other people have pointed out, it's the only book in the series where he's the only real criminal. Everybody else is in the straight world. And I'll let it go with that and let somebody else comment.
Yeah, good stuff. You know, I think that it's hard to imagine anybody else really pulling this off, because you're writing, you know, within such a narrow parameters. You're writing heist novels, basically one after the other, with a handful of plots that can happen, with some formulaic elements in the structure of it. And to do that, and do that well, repeatedly, it's not as easy as it looks, I would have to say. Sean, your thoughts on, I know you have a favorite era.
Oh yeah, my favorite era is probably going to be the I call it the original era, and much like Tony said, there's a darkness, there's a seediness, there's a, like I said, a earthiness almost to those books where, I love Comeback. I think Comeback was very good. Like I said, Firebreak was the first Parker novel that I read, and Flashback, or I think that's the incorrect title, but. And those novels are they're part of the Claire epoch, if you will. And I don't know, not to sound controversial, but you know, I wouldn't say it to his face, but Parker's a little soft in the Claire novels. I mean, he's still hard. He's still, you know, he'll kill somebody if necessary. But there's almost a domestication to him that's not. It's like he's a wolf in The Hunter and The Score and The Jugger. And in the Claire novels, he's an attack dog. And they're both deadly, but there's a difference. And for me, the first era stands head and shoulders above the rest. I love the leanness of it. I love the underworld aspects of it. It's this separate entity, this separate world, but it's not a pastiche. It's never played for laughs. It's never taken for granted. There's a true danger to get caught. There's a true danger to going to prison in the early novels. Not to say he's not going to get caught in the later ones, but he's almost such a professional by the end. You get the feeling that even if it all breaks down to hell, he'll get away. In the first few novels, there's still this sense of danger that he may not make it. And you know, and I think Westlake is to be commended for allowing Parker to live after The Hunter and through the other novels. It's easy to write a heist novel where you have your main character do a heroic or anti-heroic death, you know, and we all get that final cinematic scene of him, you know, vanquishing his enemy. It's hard to figure out a way to make them survive all this, you know, this maelstrom of shit that's going on. So my favorite novel is a tie between The Hunter and The Seventh. And the reason Seventh is one of my favorites is because they made a really good blaxploitation movie called The Split with Jim Brown as the character, and so I love The Seventh because it was the movie was based on that.
Well, you know, I see it the same way, Sean. I think there was when I kind of see the softening of Parker happening. If you look at the end of the end of the handle, Alan Grofield, the guy's got 6 bullets in him. He's walking through the Mexican desert, and you know there's no way anybody's going to come to this guy's aid, but Parker does. Even Grofield is amazed that Parker comes and rescues him, and Parker just says, you know, we're on a job together. And then the very next book is when he meets Claire. So I think there's almost like a line that he crosses at that point that you start to see him soften as a character. Maybe he doesn't even realize it himself. Rob, your thoughts on the eras of Parker?
Well, I find it damn near impossible for me to prefer either the first era or the second era over the other, and those are my two favorites. I'd like to spend $100 on the Daily Double of Slayground and Plunder Squad because I think I'm going to win. I mean, they did that consecutive, and I haven't read Deadly Edge. I mean, maybe I should go for the trifecta, but I haven't read the goddamn book yet. To me, when you get past the score books, at least a couple of which are really good anyway. I mean, I really like the rare coin score and the sour lemon score. And one of those I haven't read yet. It's actually on my bed. You know, it's just a really solid era. And while the first era starts great, I don't like all the books as consistently as I seem to like all the books in the second era. You could just tell me those are the only books. You could give me the first era and tell me those are the only books you have to read for the rest of your life, and I'd be perfectly happy. But it doesn't win.
Well, fortunately, fortunately, we now live in an era where you don't have to, you know, find these in some book collector's shop. You know, they're all out there now, which is just beautiful.
Yeah, except for the
covers. So, guys, I've got – well –
can I hit a follow-up question on this real quick, Greg?
Yes, sir.
I had somebody who was asking me, too. It was – we were like, what book – if you had to tell somebody, hey, man, you got to read one book from the Parker series to talk you into Parker, what book would it be? I'm kind of curious about Slayground myself because I'm like, that's like a creepy, dark, Die Hard in a backwoods carnival. You know, like Slayground to me is Slayground or Deadly Edge. But like if there's, like what book would you guys recommend if you had to turn somebody on to Parker with one book, which one would it be?
I'm with you on Slayground.
I love Slayground.
It's hard to go against
love,
the Hunter, but.
Yeah, I like them all. I would almost never recommend The Hunter because even though it is the beginning of the series, I think it's so unlike the rest of the series that it doesn't give you that fair an idea. For people that really love crime fiction, I'd say you can't go wrong. For just regular readers, again, I'd go with Comeback because I think it's a good general introduction to it. It's a solid book, and it'll give you a good idea what the series is about.
I don't think you can
go
wrong
with
any of those.
Yeah, I go with The Jugger just because it reminds me of Now, bear with me. I'm gonna go far afield here, but it reminds me of the John Wick movies, where it drops you in the middle of this world, and he respects your intelligence enough to catch up. You know, this is what because I remember seeing the cover. I'm like, what the hell is a jugger? And so I pick it up, and And you start reading it, and it's like, oh, well, okay, got you. And you're in this world immediately. You know, it's like this, you know, acid. It's this dark acid infused Wizard of Oz world where you're dropped in the middle of it, and you just got to catch up and let's go. But for me personally, friends that I want to get turned on to Parker or turned on to Stark, I'll let them read that, and they'll want to know more about this organization, the outfit, and the mob, and so on and so forth. So that's just my two cents.
Yeah, I think you can't go wrong with any of those. This is a relevant question for me because I'm actually the guy I was talking to yesterday. I'm going to send who's not read anything by Richard Stark. I'm going to send him a copy of one to kind of get him introduced. And I've been asking myself this, you know, over the last couple of days, and I think I've kind of settled on Firebreak. I think it's a good introduction, and there's not, you know, you don't really have to have read one of these before you've read any of the others, but there is something to reading them in sequence as well. But just to kind of initiate somebody into the world of Richard Stark, that's the one I've kind of settled on.
I would argue that you cannot read Ask the Parrot or Dirty Money without having read Nobody Runs Forever. You can't.
Well, you're absolutely right because they pick up immediately after the one before. That's a good point.
Yeah.
So I want to talk just a minute, guys, about adaptations. You know, there's been a number of adaptations based on Stark's Parker stuff. Darwin Cook put out a few excellent graphic novels. There have been a number of movies, you know, everything from Jean-Luc Godard's Made in the USA to Lee Marvin and Point Blank to others even more recent. So, you know, Eric, I'm thinking of, you know, you as a filmmaker and a reader of Stark, you know, can you weigh in on the adaptations in the movies and other media? And, you know, what stands out to you from these peripheral things based off of Stark stuff?
It's hard. I mean, it's hard for me to be too objective, like, because I'm always reading a book first. So, you know, like, I think the best example is the actual Parker movie with Jason Statham. Like I said earlier, I think that usually Parker is the least interesting of the characters. So, therefore, who's playing the main characters doesn't matter. It should be the side characters. In the Parker movie, I don't think that they did a really, really good job in casting the side characters. They had a great cast, but they didn't give them meaty role. The only meaty role really went to J-Lo. Bobby Cannavale, who's great, they didn't do anything with his character at all. In fact, there was no resolution to his character. So that was a pretty stupid one. Payback was pretty cool. It was nonstop. But in both of those movies, I just kept finding myself wondering why they were making the choices they did when you had the movie. Parker did a great job. If there's anyone out there that can help me find the Terry Bradford version of Slayground with Peter Coyote, I'd love to see that, man. Like I said, Slayground's one of my favorites, and I'm looking for it. I can't find it on Netflix. I can't find it on anything.
I saw half an hour of that, and I couldn't keep watching it. No, it was awful. It had nothing to do with the book. It weirdly has some of the lines. It has some snippets of the conversation between Parker and the guy who shows him the job, the old man, the old crook that says he was looking at the back of his neck in the barbershop mirror and he saw that the 11s were up. That conversation is in there, but the rest of it has nothing to do with the book at all. It's just bizarre.
When Boner is gone, well, that's a joke.
yeah, it was, and I was very excited. It came on TV, and I thought, oh man, this is going to be great, and it's not. Robert Duvall made one of these movies, The Outfit.
Yeah.
And it follows the book pretty well, but
they kind of make Robert Duvall a sort of happy-go-lucky good old boy.
He's no Parker.
No, no. And I think all of those movies fail, honestly. I mean, I liked Lee Marvin in Point Blank a lot, and if anybody could play Parker, it would be Lee. But they, you know, they sort of made it a different story, and it...
they added a twist
had,
in it that I didn't think.
Look, he had the look and he had the affect, but the rest, and I do like the movie, but it's not The Hunter. And Mel Gibson was just too short in Payback, and the end is bizarre. And for me, they all kind of fail.
Yeah,
what about
J-Lo's
I think so too.
Intoxicating
I think...
performance. In Parker.
Well,
he is,
yeah,
no Stark.
Yeah, yeah.
Stark wrote that the real estate saleswoman who worries about her future. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Parker movie with Jason Statham was so bad. It like I wanted to wash my eyes. I would bleach after I saw it. honestly, if to me personally. And I claim no racial bias for this, but the split, I thought if you wanted to talk about a character regardless of their physical attributes, but their the aura, the charisma, or the emotion, I guess, or emotionlessness of Parker, Jim Brown was great as he was a character. They changed it to McLean. They didn't call him Parker, obviously. But his I'm the smartest guy in the room swagger was palpable in that movie. Now, the rest of the movie suffers from the poor production values of the time and of the genre. But there's something about him when he walks on screen, you see him, you know, you get the aura of Parker, if not the actual character. I thought Payback started really well. And just as Tony said, it just... If they had ended it like the book ended it, I think it would have been all right because Chris Christopherson was great in there as one of the you know the triple headed monster that was the head of the outfit. He was fantastic, and you know my God, they had Lee Coburn in there playing one of James Coburn, excuse me, playing one of the bosses as the head of the outfit, and William Devane. Those three guys were perfectly cast as the like I said, a three-headed monster that's the bosses of the outfit. Like I said, Payback had a great look. Greg Henry as Mal, they changed it to Val. Didn't really make a difference. I don't know why they did that. But he was incredibly smarmy. Like, I wanted to shoot him in the face as soon as he stepped on screen. It was just every minute he was on screen, it's like, I want to put a .45 in your mouth. And that's a great sign of a great actor. He really embodied the Mal character, but like Tony said, I never bought Mel Gibson as Parker, and not just the physical attributes. He just wasn't. I just didn't feel tough enough. I felt him acting,
yeah,
as opposed to him acting. So,
I kind of thought as Mel Gibson as Parker, he, you know, of course Parker starts the book with a suit that's too big, right? You know, he's walked, you know, he's hitchhiked across
right.
the company, country, whatever. But I almost think that Mel Gibson tried to look sloppy, whereas Parker was trying to fit in. You know, it was almost
right.
like Mel Gibson was flaunting this
yeah.
thing. And I think that I haven't seen all of the movies, but I kind of think that, you know, we have the perspective of time. And we see these books for what they are today. And I don't know that you know, the filmmakers knew what they had so much back in the day, because remember, these were, you know, on the shelves in the dime store, you know, and the kind of the prurient covers. So I don't know that anybody really tried to make a true Parker movie until Payback. And I agree. I think they failed there. I do want to mention a movie that's not attributed to Richard Stark or the Parker character, and that's City of Industry. Harvey Keitel, I felt like in that movie, came as close as anybody to Parker. He didn't say a lot. He was driven. He was determined. He ultimately got his way. Not attributed to a Parker book, anything by Stark, but I think that was as close as anybody's come cinematically.
I think personally that where City of Industry succeeds, where all of the other adaptations fail, is that they realize that there were that all of the important characters. Like, it's like James Bond. You can replace James Bond every couple of years. He's not the most interesting character. It's the villain. It's the other guys. It's the side character. It's the femme. It's all of the other people that are going to be way more interesting than Parker. And City of Industry nailed it with Famke Janssen, Stephen Dorff, you know, homeboy, the brother, you know, Roy's brother. You know, they did a great job with that. So I kudos to them.
It was well
agreed.
Shot.
Yeah, I like that. I like that movie a lot too. There's another film that's very Parkerish called The Limey with Terrence Stamp. I think it's a Steven Soderbergh film, and it's different in that it's not a heist and it's a revenge movie. The premise is that this guy Wilson, again, you only get the last name, Wilson's coming to L.A. from after being released from prison in Britain, and he's coming to because he wants to find out he just got word that his daughter died violently, and he wants to get to the bottom of it, and he does it in a very Parkerish type way, and. That's worth watching. That's a good movie.
Just real quick, two movies that I don't think they're not directly Parker adaptations, but I see so many parallels. They're a part of the Parker family tree to speak, is James Caan's 1981 Thief, which is a masterful crime novel, a crime movie on its own without any Parker affectations. But the main character is Parker-esque, in that he is a precise and ruthless professional, and he only acts out, so to speak, when he's wronged about his money, not the personal stuff, not anything personal. When they don't pay him the money he's owed, he takes that as a personal affront. And that movie, for all of its 1980s glitz and glamour and neon infused technicolor landscape, it is very much at its core a Parker-esque movie. And I think we'd be remiss without remarking that movies like Heat are very Parker-esque and are really – I don't know if they exist without Parker. Neil McCauley, Robert De Niro's character in Heat, is a postmodern Parker, so to speak. He's ultimately incredibly professional, ultimately incredibly ruthless. He has a woman in his life, but he'll leave her, as he says in the movie – you know, pack a bag in 5 minutes, I can be gone. You got to be willing to walk away from everything. And so the crew around him is a Parker-esque crew, a ragtag, a group of professionals. And, you know, ultimately they get hemmed up, so to speak, by something that's out of their control. You know, they misjudge or something that's out of their control. They misjudge the timing on a bank heist. And so a movie like Heat, F definitely owes a great debt of gratitude to the Parker novels.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the impact of Parker, Stark, Westlake, it's immeasurable, you know, on this type of crime fiction. I know that I would never have been able to have written my novels without having read the Stark novels. You know, just the very beginning, the impact that those had on me, and I can trace it pretty much every step of the way from there. It's directly attributable to being exposed to those books, and I think it's fair to say that there's been a profound impact on movies, and you know, who knows the extent. Would there be a Grand Theft Auto video game if not for Richard Stark? You know, who knows. So guys, I'm going to close this out, but I just want to check first, you know, if there's, you know, any other thoughts, anything else you guys want to throw out there before we do?
I did find that I thought of all of the people, of all of the characters that Parker probably could represent in greater literature, that he was he's definitely the Jesus figure. He came back to life early on. He has a set morality, and there's a series of books written by humans about enforcing that morality. So Parker is definitely the Jesus of noir fiction.
Man, I don't think we can top that, Eric. So guys, you know, I'm going to bring us in for a landing. This has been such a fun episode of this show. I want to thank Sean Cosby, Eric Pruitt, Tony Knighton, Rob Pierce for being on the panel. And I encourage the listeners out there to check out Richard Stark's Parker series and check out these guys' works as well. You're going to love it. So join me again next week. My guest. Yes, go ahead. Sorry.
I was saying thank you, Greg.
Yeah, hey, thanks, Greg.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Greg.
This
is that required
been a tremendous,
now?
Tremendous fun. Say again?
I said, is that required now? Do I have to thank you? I already thanked you at the start
yeah,
of the fucking
for it,
show.
Rob. We're going
yeah,
to get you
Greg.
Out of the floor here, Rob.
Next we'll be hugging.
That's it. So join me again next week. My guest is going to be author Robert Randisi. This is the man who's written over 500 novels, and we're going to be talking about Lady Gunsmith, the legend of Roxy Doyle, which comes out in the next 2 or 3 days. And until next time, this is Greg Barth with Noir on the Radio, and Noir on the Radio is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC.